Ladies and gentlemen, we speak to you from the Grand Ballroom of Hotel Commodore, New York City, where some 1,300 guests are gathered to celebrate Jackson Day, the traditional day of celebration of the Democratic Party. This Jackson Day dinner and similar gatherings throughout the length and breadth of the United States are to be addressed this evening by the President of the United States, whose voice will be carried to them from Washington. Here with us in New York City is the Honorable James A. Farley, Postmaster General of the United States, whose honor it will be to introduce the President to this great audience. Mr. Farley has just been introduced here by United States Senator Robert Wagner, as he has been introduced in each community where a Jackson Day dinner is held by the Toastmaster of that occasion. He is standing, waiting to speak to his visible audience in the Commodore Hotel and to the great radio audience waiting for this celebration. The next voice you hear will be that of Mr. James A. Farley.
Senator Wagner, Governor Lehman, Mrs. Roosevelt, ladies and gentlemen, it is now my very great pleasure to present to you, speaking in Washington, the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, when speaking before a party gathering in these modern days, I am happy to realize that the audience is not confined to active members of my own party, and that there is less of unthinking partisanship in this country today than at any time since the administration of George Washington. In the last campaign in 1936, a very charming lady wrote me a letter. She said, "I believe in you, and I do wish that I could vote for you. But you see, my parents were Republicans, and I was brought up as a Republican, and so I have to vote for your opponent." And my reply to her ran as follows. My father and grandfather were Democrats, and I was born and brought up as a Democrat. But in 1904, when I cast my first vote for a president, I voted for the Republican candidate, Theodore Roosevelt, because I thought he was a better Democrat than the Democratic candidate. I've told that story many times, and if I had to do it over again, I would not alter that vote. Conditions and parties change, as we know, with every generation. Nevertheless, I cannot help but feel pride in the fact that the Democratic Party, as it exists today, is a national party representing the essential unity of our country. And as we move forward under our present momentum, it is not only necessary, but it is right that the party should slough off any remains of sectionalism and class consciousness. Party progress cannot stop just because some public officials and private or local groups fail to move along with the times. Their places will be amply filled by the rising generation. That's on the principle that nature abhors a vacuum. In these recent years, the average American seldom thinks of Jefferson or Jackson as Democrats or of Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt as Republicans. He labels each one of them according to his attitude toward the fundamental problems that confronted him as president when he was active in the affairs of government. These men stand out because of the constructive battles they wage, not merely battles against things that were temporarily evil, but battles for things that were permanently good. Battles for the basic morals of democracy, which rest on respect. Respect for the right of self-government and faith in majority rule. They knew with the experience of wisdom that the majority often makes mistakes. But they believed passionately that rule by a small minority class unfailingly makes far, far worse mistakes. For rule by class takes counsel from itself and fails to heed the problems and therefore the good of all kinds and conditions of men. In the long run, the instincts of the common man, willing to live and to let live, they work out those instincts, the best and safest balance for the common good. And that is what I mean by the battle to restore and maintain the moral integrity of the democracy. At heart, some of the small minority on the other side seek and use power to make themselves masters instead of servants of mankind. At heart, they oppose our American form of government. That is the cause of the great struggle that we are engaged in today, a struggle for the maintenance of the integrity of the morals of democracy. And we're in the process of winning it. Let me talk history. President Washington, feeling his way through the organizing years of the Infant Republic, questioned whether government would not be most safely conducted by the minority of education and of wealth. But Jefferson saw that this control, if long exercised by a minority, would be destructive of a sound, representative, democratic system. He preached the extension of the franchise and government more responsive to the public will. Against Jefferson were almost all the newspapers and magazines of the day. And so to disseminate his policies in every hamlet and town, his associates resorted to printing simple leaflets and pamphlets. We know that the handful of printers and editors who helped them were harried and arrested under the sedition law and with the full approval of the great papers and magazines of that time. That, my friends, was the first effort with the cooperation of the owners of the press to curb the essential freedom of the press. And it failed just as any similar effort would fail today. Times went by. Men were not eternally vigilant, and once more the control of national affairs was maneuvered into the hands of a group of citizens, small in number. The government's face was turned towards the handful of citizens of the seaboard. That small group that owned the Bank of the United States and the great merchant and shipping companies. The government's back was turned on the tens of thousands of pioneers who were settling the mountain regions and spreading over into the new country that lay westward to the Mississippi. Jackson took up the battle of these pioneers of the West and the battle of the inarticulate poor of the great cities. For that, like Jefferson, he was called a rabble-rouser. He had to fight the same evil that Jefferson fought, the control of government, government itself, by a small minority, instead of by a public opinion duly heeded by the Congress, the courts, and the President. The Bank of the United States was the purse and the sword of the opposition. And with it were aligned all those who, like the early Federalists in Jefferson's time, were at heart in favor of control by the few. With it were aligned all the nationally known press of the day, with the exception of free newspapers. The bank sought to array all the money in the country against him. No one who reads the history of that period can allege that either Jefferson or Jackson attacked all the bankers, all the merchants, or all of those of wealth. Nor can anyone say that even a majority of those elements of the population were opposed to either one of them. The fight was won, as all such fights are won in the long run. Won because Jackson was fighting on the side of the people, whose instincts did not fail him. He was fighting for the integrity of the morals of democracy. Another generation went by. Lincoln emerged and was scorned for his uncouthness, his simplicity, his homely stories, and his solicitude for the little man. He faced opposition far behind his battle line, from those who thought first and last of their own selfish aims. Gold speculators in Wall Street who cheered defeats of their own armies because thereby the price of their gold would rise. Army contractors who founded fortunes at the expense of the boys at the front. A minority unwilling to support their people and their government unless their government would leave them free to pursue their private gains. Lincoln, too, fought for the morals of democracy. And had he lived, the South would have been allowed to rehabilitate itself on the basis of those morals instead of being reconstructed by martial law and carpetbaggers. There followed, as we remember, after 1865, and lasting for many years, an uninspired, commercialized era in our national life, lighted briefly by the stubborn integrity of Grover Cleveland. Then came Theodore Roosevelt and the resurgence of the morals of a democracy. He too preached majority rule to end the autocracy of the same old type of opposition. He pleaded for decency, strenuous decency, in public as well as in private life. He laughed at those who called him unprintable names and challenged again the small minority that claimed vested rights to power. You and I, in our day and generation, know how Woodrow Wilson carried on his fight. And if the cataclysm of the World War had not stopped his hand, neither you nor I would today be facing such a difficult task of reconstruction and reform.